This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. This week, Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood and G.K. Butterfield toured historic downtown Goldsboro to see several revitalization projects, including the historic Union Station. L.C. Morris has an update on Goldsboro's revitalization efforts and the struggle to secure funding for the projects.
It's in its final round now. Approval or denial of the City of Goldsboro request for a $14 million grant from the Transportation Investment Generating Economic Recovery Program. The city is looking to use the Tiger Discretionary Grant Program to make improvements to Center Street and upgrades to Goldsboro's historic Union Station, which served passenger trains between 1909 and 1968.
We are in need of a lot of large capital improvement projects. We conducted a downtown master plan for the first time ever in 2006, which was adopted unanimously by our elected officials in 2007. And it was a very ambitious plan. It identified a lot of public and private investment projects that would really move our downtown forward.
Julie Thompson is the Downtown Goldsboro Development Corporation director.
This is the fourth round of Tiger funding, and the first round was just for projects that were in planning phases. But every round since then, the last three rounds of Tiger funding, have been dedicated for construction of planned projects. But their criteria is pretty specific and pretty competitive. It makes projects very competitive. They almost have to be shovel-ready. They have a very short time frame in which you can encumber and use the funds.
Congressman G.K. Butterfield, District 1, wrote an open letter to Secretary Ray LaHood at the end of March in support of the approval of Goldsboro's Tiger IV grant.
Congressman Butterfield has been a friend of Goldsboro and downtown Goldsboro particularly for some time, and he sees the value in these projects as far as their ability to create jobs and spur small business and economic development in our community.
Thompson says the $14 million project will expand public transportation and renovate the downtown area by restoring historic infrastructure.
One of which is the Goldsboro Union Station project, which is a multimodal transportation facility, which is about 2 to 3 blocks away from the center core of our downtown. And the other is a infrastructure project that will both change the functionality and the aesthetics of our main corridor, which is called Center Street in Goldsboro. It's 6 blocks long, and it runs through the heart of downtown and is the kind of welcome mat for 49 different businesses that exist currently.
The money would be split between the streetscape project and Union Station.
Large projects like these, there's typically a lot of approvals that need to be had throughout the process, environmental studies, construction drawings and schematic drawings and all that. So you have to be prepared to be able to be ready for these type of grant fundings. And we have just gotten to the point that make us eligible and competitive for these grant fundings. Although the need has been there for quite some time, we weren't quite ready.
Union Station was placed on the National Register of Historic Places in 1977. The North Carolina Department of Transportation purchased Union Station and adjoining acreage in July 2007 to preserve and adaptively reuse as a modern multimodal center. NCDOT has now passed ownership to the City of Goldsboro. It will eventually become a one-stop shop.
The Union Station will eventually become, when I say a multimodal transportation facility, it will truly have options for transportation choices. It'll serve Gateway, which is our local transit provider that provides both urban and rural transit services to our community within Wayne County. And construction of that project, we're hoping, will begin in 2013. And that is just one part of the overall project, but it's going to take place on the property or the Union Station site. And then Union Station, as it's developed, will be the hub for passenger rail service. And then together they'll also make room for Gateway and Trailways to serve there as a hub, and then taxi service as well. So it could basically be a one-stop shop for transportation choices for people not only locally but regionally as well.
Congressman Butterfield's letter stated that businesses and people have been leaving the area since the 1960s. He also referenced an economic study showing that Goldsboro is facing an 8.7% unemployment rate.
We're just asking for $11.4 million in federal funding, and of course, the remaining portion of the $14 million project will be supported with local funds. But that is just a small portion of the overall project. It's the immediate priority needs for both developing the Center Street Streetscape project and Union Station. And I believe, if I remember correctly, in our application we stated that $14 million will create 275 jobs, I believe. And then moving forward with the continual development of the overall project, the project will create or sustain 700-some jobs.
Goldsboro's unemployment rate is much higher now. As of February of this year, it was at 11.4%. Restoring downtown Goldsboro has drawn national attention. This week, U.S. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood visited the historic downtown at the request of Congressman G.K. Butterfield. Julie Thompson, who now goes by the last name Metz, fills us in on the two-hour tour that began at the current Gateway facility.
We drove down Center Street to talk about the streetscape project. Like I said, we finished one block in November, so we have an example of where we're going towards, and then we have the other five blocks to show what it looks like today. And then from there, we went to Union Station, and Judge Charles Gaylor provided a historic briefing of the station and the development of Goldsboro around the station. And then Alan Paul, a representative of the North Carolina Department of Transportation Rail Division, gave a briefing on the plans for the project and why it's important to the state to reach their vision to create more passenger rail service through Eastern North Carolina.
As far as completion goes for the revitalization of downtown Goldsboro, that date depends on funding.
Right now, the Transfer Center is much more doable project, at least from a financial resources capacity, about $3.3 million of anticipated construction cost. And we've already received a little over $1.2 million to go towards that project through an appropriation that Congressman Butterfield got for us in that project in 2009, and then another grant that was received from the FTA last year.
The $14 million Tiger IV grant has yet to be approved. I'm L.C. Morris.
An unusual underwater fishing tournament takes place at the coast at the end of this month. The nonprofits Eastern Carolina Artificial Reef Association and Carteret Catch are sponsoring the first ever If You Can't Beat 'em, Eat 'em spearfishing tournament. Janelle Fleming is a researcher at the University of North Carolina's Institute of Marine Sciences in Morehead City and also a coordinator of the event. She says tournament goers will see three different marine species.
There's the lionfish division, there's the lobster division, and then there's the miscellaneous edible fish division. And it's a way to basically like to inform the public about the invasive lionfish species and also to collect lionfish to bring it to the local restaurants that are around here.
The exotic-looking lionfish is about a foot in length and has long flowing spines along its back and dorsal fins. It has a white body with brownish-orange stripes. Lionfish are originally from the tropic waters of the Indian Ocean, the West and Central Pacific Ocean, and the seas connecting the two in the general area of Indonesia. How the destructive lionfish ended up here in eastern North Carolina remains a mystery. Fleming says the beautiful but poisonous fish compete with native species for food and habitat.
These fish are voracious eaters. There is no natural predator for them in the Atlantic Ocean. So they can reproduce, once they reach sexual maturity, they can lay about 30 eggs every 4 days. And they will eat all of the juvenile groupers and the juvenile crustaceans and all of the juveniles that all of our commercial fishing people like to collect to bring into our restaurants.
Lionfish started becoming a noticeable problem off the coast of North Carolina more than a decade ago. Since then, Fleming says lionfish populations have exploded. Density ranges between 200 and 500 per 10,000 square meters. By comparison, grouper usually range between 78 and 300 fish for the same area. Not only are lionfish deadly for native fish species, they're also hard to catch.
To hang out by the bottom, and they like to hide underneath substrate, so if it's rocks or wrecks. And so if you use a hook and a line, you're not going to be able to catch them.
During the tournament, scuba divers and free divers will use spears to catch the lionfish. They'll be fishing at a spot that's known for having an abundance of lionfish, the shipwreck site of the Naco, a tanker that was torpedoed more than 40 miles off the coast in 1942. I traveled from Beaufort with a group of divers in October 2009 to the Naco for one of the first lionfish roundups.
I actually caught three. One of them got away. He was smart. He stuck his quills through the bag, so we couldn't get him down. I couldn't get him down inside the bag.
When hunting lionfish, one has to be careful of their poisonous spines. On that trip, a diver came up out of the water, cradling his hand. He later explained that he was stung twice, trying to guide a lionfish into the collection bag.
What does it feel like?
It feels like a very bad bee sting.
10 divers were part of that lionfish roundup. They weren't spearing the lionfish on that particular day. Instead, divers were collecting live specimens to be used for research. NOAA biologist Dave Serino explained.
We're trying to collect as many live lionfish as we can so that we can bring them back to the lab and get them to release eggs, and we'll try to fertilize those eggs and rear the larvae. There's very little known about the early life stages of the lionfish. It has not been well described, so we're going to try to grow them up through their larval stage and describe that.
A total of 45 live lionfish and 16 egg masses were collected during the 2009 lionfish roundup. Serino said, unfortunately, none of the lionfish eggs hatched, probably due to the stress of being caught. Keeping the fish alive for research isn't something they'll be concerned with during the If You Can't Beat 'Em, Eat 'Em tournament at the end of May, because the lionfish caught during the 10-day event will be prepared and eaten. You have to be careful of their venomous spines, but lionfish taste pretty good.
They are, it's white meat, very, very tender. Just, to me, it tastes a lot like flounder, but I love it. It's just very, very tasty.
The lionfish speared during the tournament will be donated to a local restaurant, but not before scientists take meticulous notes on which site the lionfish were caught, the diver's depth and length of dive, as well as an estimate of the number of lionfish at each diving site. Event coordinator Janelle Fleming says the data will help them track lionfish populations.
What we hope to do is keep the numbers down so that our native populations of fishes, whether it's groupers or flounders or even the crustaceans, can actually grow in those certain areas. So kind of creating a marine reserve sites at different areas.
The tournament runs from Friday, May 31st through Sunday, June 9th in Beaufort. Proceeds from the $20 registration fee will benefit the nonprofits Carteret Catch and Eastern Carolina Artificial Reef Association.
The person who comes away with the most number of lionfish caught on a particular reef or particular area will collect $500 as part of this tournament.
If you'd like more information on the If You Can't Beat 'Em, Eat 'Em tournament, or you'd like to hear the entire lionfish roundup feature, go to publicradioeast.org and click on the picture of the lionfish. The Down East Journal is made possible by our members in partnership with Carolina East Health System, New Bern, caring for coastal North Carolina families for 50 years. Carolina East Health System, your partner in health. Online at carolinaeasthealth.com.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, with this week's entry in the Garden Journal. It's likely you're going to start seeing paper wasps soon, possibly even in your house. Early in the spring, about now for this part of North Carolina, overwintering paper wasp queens are going to emerge and become active. They've passed the winter in voids in walls or in attics or crawl spaces, but it's just the queens at this point. Because they've spent the winter in protected areas, inside or near homes, Sometimes you'll find them indoors this time of year. Again, this is generally a single queen, and she has no nest to defend at this point, so she's not going to be aggressive. Most of the time, a rolled-up newspaper is all you need to get rid of a queen that has strayed into your house. The queens outdoors are going to be acting differently. You might see hundreds of wasps hovering near chimneys or other vertical objects. They're scoping out prospective nesting sites. Most nesting sites are going to be on roof overhangs, in gutters, underneath porches, and decks. Generally, the masses of up to hundreds of wasps you see this time of year are going to be too high to make it sensible or safe to attempt any chemical or mechanical control. Last year, I saw hundreds of them around the top of a windmill in our county. And of course, there was no way anyone could reach them at this point. Right now, just watch and see where they begin building a nest. Paper wasp nests are gray, papery, honeycomb-like cells. Once the first cells have been constructed, tiny, white, sausage-shaped eggs are laid, and they'll hatch within a few days. When the nest is small and workers have not yet emerged, you are not going to have wasps defending the nest, so it's much easier to knock it down and get rid of it before it gets larger. If you wait until the nest is matured and workers have emerged, they will be defending the nest, and they can become quite aggressive. It's this protection of the nest that makes the wasp something you don't necessarily want around your home or barn or outbuilding. But except for that possible sting, these wasps are actually beneficial insects. Yes, they are. The female wasps catch caterpillars, many of the kinds that you might find as a pest in your vegetable garden. They chew up these caterpillars and feed them to the young before the cell is sealed so that the young can pupate. Only you know your tolerance for paper wasp nests around your house and yard. But remember, the single wasp that you see emerging now, those are the queens. Easy to eliminate without having to unload an entire can of wasp spray. If you do wait too late and have a mature nest near your house that's causing a risk for people coming and going, well, the best way to control that is at night when all the wasps are at home, from a distance, well covered up, using a spray designed specifically for wasps that will shoot a foam a long distance to keep you safely away while you're protecting your home. So watch out for those new wasps coming, and I'll talk to you in next week's entry in the Garden Journal.
There's another insect you'll start seeing soon, but this one doesn't have a stinger. It's the 17-year cicada. And as Steve Biddle of WFDD in Winston-Salem explains, they'll be here any time now, and there's no way to avoid them.
It may be fairly quiet at the moment, but very soon, that'll all change. As the 17-year cicadas emerge from the ground looking for love, and the cicada circle of life continues. This particular group, or brood as they're called, is brood 2. There are broods of 17-year, 13-year, and even 1-year cicadas emerging in different places at different times. The last time these noisy insects were above ground, Bill Clinton was president. Dr. Bill Connor, an entomologist in the Wake Forest University Biology Department, explains what they do down there all that time.
They're eating underground and from roots of different plants, and they're very, very slow growing. So what's going to happen when the soil temperature hits 64 degrees, the final instar nymphs are going to make emergence holes out of the soil, and they'll crawl up the base of a tree, and then they'll molt into their adult stage.
As adults, for a couple of weeks after they emerge, they'll be pretty much everywhere, and the triad will be hosting a particularly large group of them. Dr. Connor says they're fairly good-sized insects, about the size of your pinky finger.
It's a gorgeous insect, actually. It's golden. Its wings are golden. It has red eyes. It's roughly an inch and a half long. If you've ever picked up one, you'll know that it has a defensive sound that it makes, and you'll drop it for sure.
Gorgeous may be in the eye of the beholder, but luckily they don't bite, they don't sting, and they don't do a lot of serious damage. But they do make noise. A lot of noise. After a few weeks, though, they'll finish what they're doing, go back underground, and won't be back until 2030. I'm Steve Biddle.
This is the Down East Journal. Public Radio East is a media sponsor for the upcoming Beaufort Music Festival on May 10th and 11th on the waterfront. This week, I spoke with Planning Committee member Sarah Phillips about what's in store for their 25th season.
Originally, when the festival first began 25 years ago, mostly people just wanted to have a chance to listen to local music and for the locals to get out and play for their friends and family. And so I think that's kind of how it started, just a few musicians that lived here in Beaufort that wanted to have an event.
How have you seen the Beaufort Music Festival grow over the past 25 years?
Bigger and better, and it's been the same weekend pretty much the whole time. So it's kind of a good time for people to get outside. Spring has come, and so people kind of get outside and enjoy the being out on the waterfront in Beaufort. And then, of course, getting the bigger names has been a big draw. And, you know, we had names in the past 7 years, such as Tiff Merritt and the Avett Brothers, Steep Canyon Rangers. Having bigger names like that kind of makes the festival something that people remember and that they know that there's going to be some good music for the next year.
You have a group of 6 local volunteers that organize this music festival. Can you talk about the work that goes into putting this event on?
Yeah, it's a lot of work. We have 6 volunteers, basically, that have helped kind of put everything together. And everyone works full-time, so basically we have meetings in the evenings or on the weekends, and we try to organize things that are going to be happening throughout the year that raise money for the festival. And then on the weekend of the actual festival, the second weekend in May, we basically have to get all the stages set up. We have to work throughout the year to get all the bands in place. The money that we've raised throughout the year, 100% of that money goes to paying the bands and getting the stages and getting the rooms and all sorts of other things. We definitely work with the community a lot to have them donate as much as we can, but we basically raise money with events throughout the year to set up the festival itself.
How do you go about selecting the bands that are going to be performing?
We want to have different types of music to bring out different types of people. So for this year, we have a lot of different types of music from a brass band, a local jazz band. We have a high school jazz band coming, and then kind of different blues and Americana and bluegrass and all sorts of different music that we hope will bring out different types of people to the event.
Now, you have some big acts performing this year at the Beaufort Music Festival. I know there's the Holy Ghost Tent Revival and the Robert Randolph Family Band.
Yeah, the Robert Randolph and the Family Band we were really, really excited about. That's a national name that people travel and pay lots of money to see at big festivals, and so we're really, really excited about Robert Randolph and the Family Band. He's been playing pedal steel since he was 15 years old, and he has a lot of different exciting things that come into play when he is at a live show. That's what people hear about is his live shows and how exciting they are. The Holy Ghost Tent Revival, we've seen them here at the music festival before, but they've gotten even bigger and better. They have a 3rd album that just came out.
And they're from North Carolina.
From Greensboro, so they're kind of local to us. And they always bring excitement to the stage. They have horns and really exciting music, and they're a good stage presence. So those 2 bands, the headliners on Friday night and Saturday night, we think will be really exciting and set up the mood for the rest of the weekend.
Now, know that parking can be an issue when you have so many people coming into downtown Beaufort. What do you plan to do to ease the congestion?
We're actually partnering with the boathouse down at the end of Front Street this year to help with transportation. Traffic and parking is kind of a problem sometimes, and so we're working with the boathouse at Front Street, and they are driving a ferry or a trolley all day long to transport people from the boathouse at the end of Front Street all the way directly down to the actual venue itself. So there will be a trolley for people so they don't have to worry about parking.
The 25th annual Beaufort Music Festival takes place on Beaufort's historic downtown waterfront on May 10th and 11th. There'll be nationally recognized artists, as well as great bands and individual acts from North Carolina, with genres including Americana, R&B, reggae, Afrobeat, folk, bluegrass, indie, and more. Headliners include the Holy Ghost Tent Revival on May 10th and Robert Randolph and the Family Band on May 11th. Admission is free. For more information, go to publicradioeast.org.
Babe, don't you cry.